Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, can state lawmakers and the governor come together to strike a deal on housing? And the sounds of Chicano English and why it's not the same as Spanglish. But first, Arizona's public universities are trying to figure out how to respond to the Trump administration's threats to pull funding over diversity, equity, and inclusion-related initiatives. At the same time, they are grappling with the fallout from grants, projects, and research funding that continues to be cut. The Maricopa County Community College District, which KJZZ is licensed to, canceled an array of programs and policies in order to protect federal funding. At the University of Arizona, the website for its DEI office was taken down, and diversity-related language was stripped from its land acknowledgement. And ASU is now calling its annual convocation ceremonies honoring diverse student groups celebrations instead. But when he came into our studios this week, ASU President Michael Crow told me they have not had to make any substantial changes to comply with federal directives because they have no diversity or DEI-related goals. As for canceled projects, Crow says, those are more than threats. They've already had dozens of canceled projects already and more being canceled every day. And he recognizes the federal government has a right to do it, but he doesn't agree with their reasoning.
The hard thing for us is that the reasons that they're giving for elimination of these grants are almost always wrong. That is, they don't have the information down to the grant level. They're making broad brush policy shifts, which is fine, but they're not looking at the specifics of the grants. The grants that we have, for instance, with the U.S. Agency for International Development are unbelievably important to the protection and advancement of American interests. We've been working in Central America to help fewer people want to flee Central America and become undocumented or illegal immigrants to the United States. We just had a project canceled yesterday, which talks about the need for vaccinations and the education about vaccinations. And so that project's been canceled. Mm-hmm. So what we're seeing is sort of a high-level policy decision, which is being implemented without discretion across all projects, all things, all activities. And it's not wise.
So what's your response then? Like when these programs get cut, this funding gets cut, these grants are gone, you're reorganizing where those employees go, they're fired. How do you handle it on an internal level?
Well, I mean, our basic strategy is that we're regrouping to be of service to the new trajectories that the government wants to move in. So it doesn't mean that there aren't going to be projects in these areas or there isn't going to be scientific research. There's going to be. And if there isn't, then the U.S. will never have any ability to attain the kinds of outcomes that the new administration is searching for. This notion of the president's moving America to the golden age of the future. Well, there's no way to do that without the universities. There's no way to do that without scientific and technological research being at the highest level on the entire planet. There's no way to do that without our interests being advanced and protected around the world through the kinds of things that we do. So we're just regrouping to be of as much service and of greater service going forward as we can be.
Are you making those arguments to the federal government, saying this is a program that should not be cut, it is in the U.S. interest?
We're making our interests known everywhere that we can using rational arguments and fact-based presentations. And we're also leaving for the record, if a project is canceled, a final statement from us that says, this is what this project was designed to do, this is what we've done, this is what we were attempting to do, this is the why for the project. I gave a talk the other day at Rice University where I talked about the invisible hand of academic science that underpins all of the technological breakthroughs from Mr. Musk's Tesla vehicles, which are based on thousands of academic inventions and discoveries and basic science, to the Steve Jobs's iPhone, which is a product of literally hundreds of thousands of academic articles. Academic research, all of which is invisible. So we're leaving for the record what we did. We're not allowing this notion of waste, fraud, and abuse, which none of our projects are involved in waste, fraud, or abuse, none of them, to be the mantra by which these things are labeled in terms of their being ended.
It's interesting because so much of what you have founded ASU on or tried to shape it around, right, is this idea of creating a new American university, right? That phrase that you talk about all the time where you have anybody can be included, that the university is part of the community. It is not in the ivory tower. Do you feel like this is a misunderstanding of what it is that universities are for from the federal government?
Well, I mean, what's going on, the Supreme Court did rule that there can't be any race-based admissions at universities several years ago. We did away with the concept of affirmative action in the first year that I came into office in 2002, 2003. What we said was that we will be what we're supposed to be, inclusive, and measure our success based on our students, and we will not measure our success based on how many students we exclude. That is, the schools that see themselves as the best are those that have the lowest admission rates. Mm-hmm. And then those schools sometimes then have to make certain that their classes are more broad, so they in the past have had specific ethnic groups identified for admission to the university because they have so few seats. We admit every qualified student, every qualified student. The second that we decided to admit every qualified student and to adjust with that and grow with that, our student body became completely representative of all of the family backgrounds and all of the socioeconomic levels in the state. And we have no DEI goals. Mm-hmm. We have no affirmative action goals. We just have an admission standard, which is the qualification to attend the university. It has worked.
So that's the way you approach the term inclusivity. But of course, inclusivity is one of these, you know, hot button words, right, in the DEI debate. And you're facing federal funding cuts again because of threats saying if universities like yours do not get rid of DEI programs, language, ideology, et cetera, we will take away funding as well. What changes has ASU made in response to that?
Long before these debates occurred, we said that we would maintain the purity of what a public university is supposed to be. So what we've done in the moment is make certain that all of our language, all of our communications reflects what we're already doing and have been doing for two decades. And so for us, there's no material change in anything. We don't have to change any policy, nothing. What's happened is that other people built that three-word phrase, diversity, equity, and inclusion, and then built a rhetoric around that, and that's what's being attacked. You know, we were past that.
So what about changing things like, you know, convocation ceremonies that used to be for specific student populations like Latino students or Native American students? Now they're being called celebrations. These are language changes to you? Are they substantive?
Well, there's only two graduations in the university, two official events. I preside over both of them. Then the colleges themselves have convocations. Mm-hmm. And then any group that would like to get together and celebrate for whatever reason, we allow them to do that as a part of the celebration with their families. And so we're completely compliant with whatever the concerns are. We don't have any concerns relative to what we're doing. We don't have any separate graduations. We don't have any separate groups. We have two graduations, undergraduate and graduate, and everything else is a convocation at the college level or a self-assembled group that's getting together to celebrate graduation.
What have you heard from students? Are there concerns from the student body saying, you know, ASU is walking away from these initiatives, this idea, this commitment to inclusion?
No, because we're not walking away from anything. We already are massively representative of the socioeconomic diversity of the country and of the state, and massively representative of ethnic diversity without any ethnic diversity goals, because we made sure that everybody that was qualified was admitted.
So it sounds like you still believe and very much believe that diversity, though, is important, and being representative of the community that you're from is essential in a university.
It's not about the idea of diversity per se. It's about the idea of America, which is an unbelievably diverse, polyglot place with people from everywhere, families from every background, people from every religious perspective that you can possibly imagine. And what we say is, well, all that's great, but if you're qualified, you're in. And we even say, if you're not qualified, we're going to find ways to help you to be qualified so you can earn your way in. So it's a completely merit-based, merit-driven, egalitarian university operating through innovations at scale to do the greatest amount of public service that we can for the greatest number of people that we can.
So as the leader of the largest public university in the country, how do you see your role right now as it seems that the federal government and these major universities are more at odds? Is it becoming more difficult, I guess, to become apolitical in light of what's happening?
What we need to do is we need to say to the national government, here we are, this is what we do. yes, we understand that you're concerned about this and this and this, but you can't throw the baby out with the bathwater here. We are a national asset of unbelievable value to the country and its ultimate success. Let's work on those things where there's policy concerns or policy differences, while at the same time, we do everything that we can to continue the unbelievable economic progress that we've made in the United States. And these kinds of things are essential to us continuing to evolve both as a democracy, but also as a society where life is better. And so we're essential to that. This is an unbelievable moment for the universities to step up and say, how can we be of greater service?
All right. ASU President Michael Crow, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Arizona is in a housing crisis, but a solution from lawmakers has proved to be an elusive goal in recent years at the state capitol. Could this year be different? Well, a bipartisan coalition of lawmakers hopes so. A new version of the so-called Starter Homes Act narrowly passed out of the state Senate last week. And now Democratic Governor Katie Hobbs is offering up her own plan to strip back some housing regulations governed by cities. This after she vetoed a similar bill last year. KJZZ's Cameron Sanchez is covering all of the competing interests at 1700 West Washington Street, and she's on the line now to tell us more. Good morning, Cameron.
Good morning.
Okay, so this really seems like one of those things that everyone agrees needs a fix. It needs to be addressed. The affordable housing crisis is real, but no one can agree on just what that fix should be. Why not?
Okay, so everyone does have a lot of ideas, so that's the good news. But the ideas are pretty radical in terms of a shift from what we have now, depending on who you ask. And there's basically opposition between lawmakers who are proposing zoning changes and the League of Cities and Towns representing Arizona municipalities who would be limited by that.
Okay, so we've got several ideas here, right, from lawmakers, from the governor. There was even another one from one of the big interest groups involved here. Let's start with what's in this bill being advanced by lawmakers. It's a bipartisan group at the state legislature. What would it do?
Okay, so this is a variation of a bill that's come back last year and includes elements of a bill from even 2 years ago. The idea of it here is that there is way too much zoning and overregulation and red tape on developers. So there's developers who have an appetite to build affordable housing in Arizona, but they're being hampered by basically these local policies and regulations. Mm-hmm. So the way to get around that is they want to cut some of the red tape by prohibiting municipalities from rejecting projects for certain reasons. Part of that is aesthetic design, such as, you know, you can't say that a developer can't build a house because you don't like the color of the house or the shape of the windows, that stuff. Mm-hmm. Part of it is also to do with the setbacks and the garages. It's called the Starter Homes Act because it's supposed to legalize or pave the way for starter homes to be built. So just a good old American home on a, you know, reasonably sized lot.
Right. And the size of the lot has been up for debate, it sounds like.
A crazy amount of debate, yes.
How different is this, Cameron, from what we saw the governor veto last year?
It is different. There are significant changes. So last year, the governor vetoed the first version of the Starter Homes Act, which made it to her desk. And she basically said that she's concerned that this, you know, doesn't strike the right balance and it could potentially even violate codes to do with, you know, fire safety and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. There have been changes. So this version of the bill makes it super, super extra, super explicit that this is not going to change building or fire codes, that it will still require housing to subscribe to that. It would also compromise a little bit on things like lot sizes. So it's not enough yet to get the League of Cities and Towns on board, but there are some small changes between this legislation and last year's.
Okay. The governor has her own plan she came out with as well, kind of in response to pressure from some of her own members that this has to be addressed. What does she want to do? What's the difference there?
So her focus is sort of on a different topic entirely, which is to do with LIHTC, that's low-income housing tax credits. Mm-hmm. Basically what that means is when you're building, developers are incentivized to set aside a number of units which would have to be affordable, meaning they would have to go to families who are lower income. So that guarantees affordable housing. And Hobbs wants to ensure that LIHTC is extended. This is it's partly a federal program. She wants to make sure that we have that for a longer amount of time and that the cap on it is lifted. Unfortunately for her, I believe there were two LIHTC extension proposals produced at the Capitol, but neither of them has moved forward. So Hobbs and the League face the same problem, which is that their bills just don't have the bipartisan support to go forward just yet.
Okay. Let's talk for a moment about the League of Arizona Cities and Towns, which has been, you know, opposing a lot of this legislation. They did have their own plan, which hasn't gone anywhere, as you said. Where do they play a role here in terms of getting all the parties maybe on board, trying to come up with some kind of solution, some kind of deal?
From the beginning, the League of Cities and Towns has been the most important stakeholder in this entire process and also the biggest opposition to what this bipartisan coalition of lawmakers has been trying to do, because what it does is strips some of the power from cities and towns. So it makes sense. I think that it's, kind of a sign that there's a real problem in Arizona that the League put up their own version this year, because they're sort of, I think, acknowledging that something does need to be done, and that if they're going to oppose these housing suggestions, then they need to have something on the table. But again, they didn't have enough bipartisan support. That bill never even made it to its very first hearing, which is how it died, just through complete neglect.
Okay, so what is next? What are you watching for, Cameron, on this front in terms of, are there negotiations happening? Are we looking for some kind of agreement between the governor and the lawmakers at the very least?
There are active negotiations happening, and they've been happening. So the governor's office is at the table, lawmakers are at the table, both sides of the aisle, and it's a bipartisan coalition. The funny thing about it is that we've got some of the far right and far left lawmakers advocating for one another on this topic, because it's just one of those weird things that sort of stretches out to certain people but not others, because it also faces really fierce bipartisan opposition. It
Interesting.
finally made it out of the state Senate recently, but it did so with the absolute minimum amount of votes. We'll see next. The next big hurdle is, can it get enough votes in the House of Representatives? And it's a bit of a wild card.
It's a bit of a wild card. We will be watching, Cameron. We'll be covering it. That is KJZZ's Cameron Sanchez joining us from our politics desk with the latest on housing negotiations at the state capitol. Cameron, thanks as always. Appreciate your reporting here.
Thank you.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, a legendary chef's journey bringing authentic Mexican food to the Valley.
I believe there's discrimination or a bias or even racism that occurs in Mexican food or towards Mexican food. It's probably the most appropriated cuisine out there. And when it says authentic Mexican food, the American palate believes that.
We'll hear from the former chef of Barrio Cafe. But first, after wildfires burn through forests, there are often efforts to replant trees in those affected areas. But new research offers some guidance on how to do that, as well as when those efforts should and should not take place. Kyle Rodman is a research scientist at NAU's Ecological Restoration Institute and lead author on the paper detailing this. He spoke with my co-host Mark Brody about what the team of scientists found, and they started with the size of this study. It looked at more than 300 fires in the western U.S., excluding the West Coast, over the course of a few decades. And Mark asked if this kind of research has really ever been done at this scale before.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So there have been a handful of studies that have looked at essentially how tree planting after fire can affect what's going on the ground, the outcomes of those activities, right? And many of those studies in the past have been focused on maybe one, two, five different wildfires that have happened in a particular state or a particular part of the country, right? But these activities are done all over the place, right? We've identified hundreds of individual wildfires all across the western U.S. that plantings have been done on federal lands in the United States. And if we don't have a sense of how well those are working across a large area, we don't really know how to, you know, whether the money that we're spending on these things is actually worthwhile, right? That's a key piece, because it's an expensive thing to do to put trees in the ground and get them out there on the landscape.
Are the different kinds of forests similar enough that what you find, you know, for example, in northern Arizona might be applicable to, you know, somewhere in Montana, for example?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, many of the forests in the western U.S. Have similar kinds of dynamics, but There are different species that grow in different places, different kinds of trees that grow in different places. There are also kind of different climatic conditions in different areas. And these are all things that we actually looked at in the study, how those factors might actually affect the outcomes of planting, right? Because people are planting all sorts of different tree species in the Western US, and they're planting those in different areas that may or may not be suitable climate for the kinds of trees that are being planted in those areas, right?
So what did you find then in terms of what strategies tend to work best after a wildfire to get trees back into those places?
Yeah, so in a lot of the places that we were looking at, plantings are typically done in the spring or fall, sometimes in the early summer, right? And there are certain things that people that do these activities have control over. They may not have control over the weather, which is important. If you're a gardener or you do, you know, this kind of work, like forestry work, weather plays a big role in the outcomes of these things. So yeah. if you're a Forest Service person, you go out and do a tree planting activity and you get a couple dry years afterwards, it's likely that you're going to see a lot of mortality. That's not something that many people have control over. What we do have control over is the kinds of places that we can plant trees. We have control over the seasons that we plant trees. And there's a certain amount of control that we have over, like, the kinds of trees that we're using, right? There are different ways of growing trees in the nursery. There are different species that you can plant in different areas. So some of the things that we found in this study, if you're planting in places that are warm and dry, it often makes sense to try to plant in the fall season, right? So after the hot, dry summer period. So those trees that go on the ground, they have a few months before things get hot and dry again, and they can sort of get their feet under them in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But if you're planting in a cool, wet area, like many places in Montana or Idaho, for example, planting in the spring can work pretty well. And traditionally, that's what's been done in a lot of those places. So it's kind of nice to see that the knowledge that people have that goes into planting these things and has for many decades kind of lines up with what we are now seeing works quite well. There's pretty good evidence that the sites that you select for planting can have a big effect on the outcome. So if you plant on, let's say, a hot, dry, south-facing slope at a low elevation site, probably you're going to have more of the planted trees die, and the ones that survive may not grow as fast as a planting that happens on like a high elevation, wetter place, right? So there's a few things that managers have kind of within their toolbox that they can control that do actually affect the outcomes of plantings.
Yeah, I was going to ask if there might be some places where wildfire goes through that just aren't really suitable to replant trees there. It sounds like in some cases there might be.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, this is something that I think many people that live in and around forests want to see places return to forest if they were there before the fire. But given kind of the combination of some of those places being pretty harsh for trees in general, and things getting hotter and drier now, there are some places that almost no matter what we do, we're not going to be able to get trees to grow back easily. So if we're thinking about how to maximize our investment and try to get the best bang for our buck, in a sense, avoiding some of those places might actually make a lot of sense, right? Where you're going to be essentially throwing money in a hole to try to get forests to grow back.
Hmm. I'm curious what you found about the timeline of some of these replanting efforts in terms of when after a fire it might be a good idea to go. And it seems like there might be some debate about whether you sort of wait and see what happens, you know, what the biome does on its own versus having people come in and move it along a little bit.
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. And I think one of the things that we often say as foresters or as ecologists is it depends. So in some places, for example, on the West Coast, there are a lot of shrubs or resprouting trees. Like aspen is a good example of this, right? But there are these trees that have this adaptation to grow back immediately after fire from roots that survived the fire. Many broadleaf deciduous trees are capable of doing that. And there are many deciduous trees and shrubs on the West Coast that grow back immediately after fire. So if you're working in an ecosystem like that, you kind of have to get in there early if you want to plant trees after a fire, right? And get things like conifers established because the site will get taken over by other species that you may or may not want in that area. But in other places, like, you know, certain areas around Arizona and other places in the Southwest where things grow back pretty slowly, we may have a little more time, right? And that's kind of a nice thing, because if we have a few years to wait and see what happens, we're going to see how the natural processes play out, and maybe some forests do recover on their own, right? So those are places we can avoid with planting, right? If planting is really intended to accelerate the recovery of forests, but they're coming back fine on their own, there's no need to do it.
Is that more of an ecological decision or a financial decision, or maybe both?
Yeah, I would say it's a combination. You know, that's one of the interesting things about this issue, is that it kind of brings in a bit of ecological decision making, but also some financial considerations, right? Like sort of the overall cost of different things. It's much, much cheaper to let a forest recover on its own than to go in with a crew and do planting,
yeah,
right? And there's also various stages of investment throughout that process. The reforestation pipeline, people call it, where the seed is collected, the seed is then brought to a nursery and stored. It's grown up in a nursery, and then those seedlings are transported to a site and planted in the ground. So there are all these different stages that lead to a pretty high cost, right? So if we're able to avoid that cost in any way, that's usually the preferred option.
All right. That is Kyle Rodman, a research scientist at the Ecological Restoration Institute at NAU. Kyle, thanks for the conversation. I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely, Mark. Thanks for chatting with me.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Fernando Hurtado is a former TV journalist at NBC and Telemundo. A while back, he was researching a story about something called Miami English, a dialect spoken in South Florida, when he ran into another phrase, Chicano English. As a Mexican American, he was intrigued. He'd heard the term Spanglish, and he wondered if Chicano English was a euphemism. So he started researching. And as he recently told the show's Sam Dingman, what he found was much more interesting.
The difference between Spanglish and Chicano English is that to speak Spanglish, you need some sort of dominance in both Spanish and English, because you're alternating between English and Spanish. The example I like to give is, oh, tomorrow I'm going to go to the tienda. Tomorrow I'm going to go to the store, where you're swapping out store for tienda. That's Spanglish. Chicano English, a lot of Chicano English speakers actually don't speak Spanish, nor have they ever. They're English dominant speakers whose English is very influenced by Spanish rhythm, Spanish phrasing, and expressions.
So that is a really fascinating part of this, that what we're talking about is more of a sensibility or a context around the English language. And as you got into this, you started to realize that you are a speaker of Chicano English.
Yeah, so I grew up in Chicago, and I went to predominantly Latino elementary schools, and I would always get told by my friends, oh, you speak white, you sound white. And I think they were alluding to my accent in English sounded very Americanized. Then I, by chance, end up going to boarding school in California, a very ritzy, very not as diverse school, very white. And there I start getting the opposite comments of like, oh, your English is a little funny. And one word that would always kind of rat me out as a Chicano English speaker, I realize now, is that I remember I would ask my friend like, oh, did we have any homework today? Versus the standard American pronunciation, which is more today.
In addition to pronunciation, though, there's also different implications of certain words. And there's one in particular that you call out in the video that's super fascinating. Tell us what that word is.
Yes, I barely realized it. The word is barely. So the word barely in standard American English means almost not. If I told you I barely made it to the store, what I'm telling you is I almost didn't make it to the store. In Chicano English, the use of barely that's more common is just now or recently. So if I said I barely made it to the store, in Chicano English, what I'm trying to say is I just arrived at the store.
Yeah. Well, so that's so interesting. Is that the result of something in the translation between English and Spanish, or is it something else?
Yes. Yeah, so the linguist I spoke to says this is a clear example of Spanish influencing English. And again, you don't have to speak Spanish to speak Chicano English, but if you're a Chicano English speaker, maybe you've heard the Spanish word apenas, which means just now, like apenas llegaste, you just got to the store. So it might be that Chicano English speakers are trying to find one word instead of just now that would tell you like, oh, I just got here.
Right, right. And then speculating, of course, if we take a speaker like the one you were just alluding to who does speak both languages and comes up with this mm-hmm. slightly different use for a word like barely, and then that person is living in a Mexican-American neighborhood like the one that you grew up in, and their kids are growing up around other kids who are native English speakers, they're mm-hmm. then growing up in this context of English where barely just means something different.
Yeah, and so that's where you might also be used to ending your questions with no. That's, I think, another mm-hmm. telltale sign mm-hmm. of like, oh, you went to the store, no? And that is influenced by, in Spanish, you do tend to end a lot of questions with no to get some affirmation. In the more, probably the more one-to-one translation would be right instead of no. Like, you went to the uh-huh. store, right?
Yep. But isn't that so interesting? There is a colloquial analog in quote-unquote standard English.
Yeah, and that opened my eyes as I did this story to the whole world of language, period, where in my interview with the linguist, she said, I'm never using the term correct or incorrect. Like, there's a correct or right. incorrect way to say something. And what she was getting at is that that's a point of language. Languages evolve over time to communicate. And there is no right or wrong way to say something per se, but you could characterize it as like, oh, there's a standard American way to say it, sure, and not so standard variety.
So what has it been like for you to come into this awareness, not just of the existence of Chicano English, but of this awareness that you yourself are speaking it? Has it changed your relationship to your own voice at all? Does it make you think about it more?
Absolutely. I think, you know, when I was in high school and my friend was commenting on how I said today, I was really self-conscious. I didn't want to be noticed for the way I spoke. And so I really made it a point to polish my English, mm-hmm. you could say. And then in doing this story, I realized, man, it's so cool that I have a variety of English that isn't spoken by everyone, but it is spoken by a lot of people in the US. And it's also a variety of English that is very American, if you think about it. It's this hyphenated American way to speak. We are made up of hyphenated Americans. And what I mean by that is we're made up of Irish Americans, Mexican Americans, Venezuelan Americans, Asian Americans, etc.
Well, this gets to the YouTube channel that you started, which is literally called In the Hyphen. And I wanted to ask you if this had ever come up for you in your career as a journalist, because one of the things that I personally found really appealing about the video that you did on this is your style of narration in the video. It feels like you're talking to a friend. You're kind of mm-hmm. conveying the information like you're sitting across the table from me at lunch and saying, like, check out this thing I just looked into. It's actually really, really interesting. Maybe you've heard these words said this way. You're not saying it in like a formal news narration type of style. And I'm curious to know, as somebody who was a journalist at a place like NBC, which is a much more corporate news environment, mm-hmm. did you feel any pressure in that environment around the way that you used your voice?
That's exactly why I launched In the Hyphen, because yes, I, you know, working at NBC and Telemundo, where I was there for 5 years, and before that, other corporate media companies, I always felt like I was putting on my like big boy American hat when I was writing a script for yeah. a video yeah. for NBC, and then I would turn around and then do a story for Telemundo, and it was the opposite, where I'd put on my Mexican hat to be sound more Mexican than I actually was. And when I say I actually was, I mean I'm Mexican American, and I will never pretend that I grew up in Mexico. I don't know what it's like to grow up in Mexico. But what I do know really well is that Mexican American experience, what I like to call, you know, living in the hyphen. And, you know, I just launched in January, and it's been really cool to get comments from non-Latinos who are like, oh my God, I relate to this so much. I don't speak Spanish. I don't speak Chicano English, but, you know, I have a version of this with, you know, my Filipino friends.
Yes. Or... yes. There was somebody who commented, I think, who said they either live on or grew up on a Native American reservation, and they have res English there.
Yes, and two things just stood out there. I'm like, I need to go somewhere in Arizona or New Mexico because people keep talking about New Mexico English. I'm also very curious about what Arizona Chicano English might sound like.
Well, we will look forward to that video perhaps appearing on the In the Hyphen YouTube channel. I have been speaking with Fernando Hurtado, who is an independent journalist, the creator of that channel. Fernando, thank you so much.
Thanks, Sam.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. We hear all the time that Phoenix is the fastest growing city in the country. It's booming. But at the same time, it's infuriatingly transient. As we documented in our series Exit Interview, it's the kind of place where you can really make your mark. But then, too often, those people who really make an impact here leave. They head off for the big time. You know, the grass is always greener. But then there are those who stick around, those who come back, and those who are somewhere in between. And that is where we turn today, to one of Phoenix's most famous chefs, Silvana Salcido Esparza, who stayed her entire career until, after 22 years, she closed her beloved restaurant, Barrio Cafe, last year. Her recently, why? Was it time?
Not for the barrio.
Right.
It was not time for the barrio. It was time for me. I'm 65 years old this summer, and I'm feeling every last bit of it.
Today, she lives on the other side of the border, in Rosarito, Baja California, where she's getting ready to release her autobiography. But she told me she'll never really leave Phoenix.
I still have a residence there. I'm still very much involved in Phoenix as a whole.
But Phoenix hasn't always been easy for Esparza. She's opened and closed beautiful restaurants like Barrio Gran Reserva and parted ways with the investors of her concept Barrio Queen. They walked away with the name. And the James Beard Award nominee has often found herself at the center of politics in some of the most divisive times in our state's history. She joined the charge against former Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio in the name of the Latino community and found artists who covered walls and fences near her restaurant with murals that told the story of their oppression. But it all began for her in culinary school. She came here to avoid San Francisco, where she thought a young person like her might be too distracted in the 1990s.
I came here and I didn't see any lesbians, much less. I went to Scottsdale to check out the school and I didn't see people of color except at the motel. And I went, oh, I'm definitely not going to get in trouble there. Huh. So here I came.
And you stayed.
And I stayed. Why did I stay?
Right.
Probably because I was broke.
She spent some years at the Phoenix Convention Center and then nearly a year backpacking through Mexico.
And when it was time to come back, I thought, L.A.? No, been there, did that. Mm-hmm. New York? I'm 40. No. Chicago, too cold. And basically, it all brought me back to Phoenix, whether I liked it or not.
At the same time, her mother had passed away from cancer, and she told me her heart was broken.
So I came here, and something very healing about the desert and the rain and how it washes off and it doesn't saturate the ground and the vastness of the valley and those hills that we can hike and meditate and the people. I healed here, and I grew armor. And then I thrived.
Barrio Cafe was a revelation in Mexican cuisine in Phoenix in the early 2000s.
This might be my only restaurant, my only opportunity to really showcase Mexico in a different light than what we're accustomed to, which is the yellow cheese, the crispy taco, the chimichangas.
Instead of chips and salsa, she served bread and tapenade. And while she got a lot of questions about where the sopapillas were on the menu, she stopped trying to explain it.
You see, I believe there's discrimination or a bias or even racism that occurs in Mexican food or towards Mexican food. It's probably the most appropriated cuisine out there. And when it says authentic Mexican food, the American palate believes that.
Yeah.
when I came in, my total intent was to, one, honor my start as a taquera inside my dad's bakeries, and most importantly, to help change those erroneous perceptions that North Americans have about Mexican food, and later on, I added, its culture.
Right. So, I mean, but this has been a theme, I think, in your career in the last decade or so, right? Like sort of pushing back against appropriation, but even like the sharing of it in this way. Like you want to protect it, it sounds like.
I want to protect it. I swore to the little ancestral cooks that I encountered and had the privilege to be with in Mexico in these remote areas, these humble dirt-floored shacks. And they were teaching me their ancestral ways. Not for me to capitalize on it, but to inspire me. And when I told them the way North Americans perceive the food and the culture and the people, they said, go back and help change that.
Yeah. You felt a responsibility.
I did. You know, I'm just kind of a responsible person, and I have a thing that my parents taught me, integrity. So, I mean, a lot of people know that I had my hands around and created a big concept that's right down the street from here.
You're talking about Barrio Queen, I'm assuming.
But I walked away because of that integrity. It's a tough road when you have to pick capitalism versus your values and your beliefs.
Right, right. Let's talk about one of the big things that happened in your career and in your life in general, which was your role in the battle against SB 1070, which was, you know, more than a decade ago now. You were really outspoken. This is when you found artists to paint the murals on the walls around your restaurant that are so poignant. Tell us about why you felt it was important to take a stand right then as a chef.
It's not like I was, oh, I'm going to say something. The newspaper called and left a message. And my business partner said, I know how you are, and I would like to ask you to measure your words. Because I was very agitated. I spoke what I thought. I thought it was a racist law. So I came out, Barrio Chef speaks out against SB 1070, headline. And that was the day everything changed. I stopped being the darling. In spite of being a lesbian, I was a darling in this town. And I stopped being a darling of many. I've got, instead of the continued support and accolades, I got from death threats to less than love letters. Since then, what I learned about myself is that anything adverse feels me.
You liked it.
I went, oh, yeah, y'all. Wait until you see what I've got next. And that's where somebody came by. We were having a mural painted behind the restaurant. It just coincided that the artist was finishing right that July of SB 1070. He was out there at 5 in the morning finishing the mural when some guy in a pickup truck pulls up, says, we don't like your kind, doing that to our walls, and showed him a gun. The artist left. He moved to New Mexico, where he lives now, and I painted more murals. It was a response to that. Artists came out, and we started including kids from the neighborhoods, kids from the local schools. Principals were bringing in troubled kids, and next thing they're bringing other kids to paint. Those kids were learning the origins of the murals, the origins of their culture, how ancestral that is, back to Mexica, Maya, Tolteca, from the making of the colors from anato, from nopal, to painting on the frescoes of the pyramids, to painting to modern-day Phoenix. It's all related. And that's what Calle 16, or our answer to SB 1070, was.
Today, Esparza is looking forward in Rosarito, Mexico, and here in Phoenix.
16th Street, Calle 16, is half finished for me. That's unfinished business.
She wants to create a culinary district along 16th Street, and her old Barrio Cafe space has an exciting future, too.
I'm a property owner. I own the buildings by Barrio Cafe. Not all of them, but a couple of them.
And I have rented them out to a Mexican chef that's going to just absolutely follow the tradition that we left behind.
More to come, she says, on the next phase for Barrio Cafe. Chef Silvana Salcido Esparza's new book is out this month, and she'll be at the Tucson Festival of Books this weekend to talk more about it. You can hear more exit interviews and Staying Power episodes on our website. That is theshow.kjzz.org. That's it for this episode of The Show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.